Well, good morning, everyone. It's our great pleasure to be here this morning. We'd like to welcome you all to the September session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. We're here today at York College. We're very excited to be here as a part of our outreach program. And we're very excited that you decided to participate and watch and observe your government at work. So this is going to be a lot of fun for us as well. So thank you for being here today. My name is Larry Welch. I am from Plattsmouth, Nebraska. That's representative of District Number 5. More on that in a second. District 5 essentially makes up about 24 counties in south central Nebraska. District 5 includes Cass County, where I'm from, but it also includes York County, where we are here today. It's my great privilege to be sitting next to Judge Mike Pirtle here to my right. Mike Pirtle is from Omaha. He's representative of District Number 2. And Judge Francie Reedman, who is sitting to my left. She is from Gretna, Nebraska, and she's representative of District 3. I know there was some introduction as it relates to who we are and what we do, but I thought I'd go over just a couple of things before we get started today. I think, as was mentioned, the Nebraska Court of Appeals was established on September 6th of 1991. We are, in fact, an appellate court. More on that in a second. But there are six of us in the state, six Court of Appeals judges representing six different districts. We sit in panels of three, so there's three of us here today, at least this morning, and then our other three Court of Appeals judges, one of whom is a graduate of York College, will be sitting here this afternoon. Court of Appeals is generally a first court to hear appeals of judgments and orders in criminal matters, civil matters, domestic relation matters, juvenile matters, workers' compensation matters, administrative board matters, agency matters, all kinds of different things. Our determination on an appeal is final unless the Nebraska Supreme Court agrees to hear the matter further. So what does an appellate court do? Well, this is not a trial court, so you're not going to see witnesses today. You won't see exhibits as such today, or a jury, or cross-examination, or things like that. That already took place. That's the trial or the hearing that takes place. As it relates to what we do then, after that takes place and a judgment is entered as a part of that process, the parties have a right to appeal to the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, depending on what it is. As it relates to that appeal then, they will assign specific errors that they think occurred at that level. They will then, in a comprehensive brief, submit those errors to us. And they will both lay out what they are, and they will argue in there what they believe to be right, or what error they believe was committed in that prior proceeding. The other side then also will file a very extensive brief where they will argue the other way. And then when all that is submitted to us, and we've thoroughly reviewed that together with the record from that proceeding, as at least as it relates to those assignments of error, they come here before us for oral argument. That's where we are today. Each side will get 10 minutes to argue their case. And if you listen carefully, I know you have the subject matter in advance, if you listen carefully today, you'll be able to hear their specific assignments of error, what they're getting at. We will ask certain questions in connection with certain things that we've reviewed. And when each party has argued for 10 minutes, the matter will be submitted, we'll make a decision, and we will issue a written opinion in connection with it. So that's our role in the process. We're very pleased that you're here today to observe that. So for counsel that is present here today, I will call your respective case. There's four of them. We'll start with case number 171237. When I call that, I will read it twice. I would ask you to come forward and sit at your respective counsel tables. Once you're here, we'll commence. I will remind you that even though we're not live streaming like we normally do when we're in Lincoln, we are in fact recording this today and this will be archived, so if there's any sensitive or confidential information, I remind you to remain aware of that. That being said, let's get started here this morning. Case number A17-1237, In Re Interest of LET. That's case 17-1237, In Re Interest of LET. Council, please come forward. Please. Switch. You want to switch tables? There we go. Are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are we ready?
May it please the court, I would ask to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal time. This case is about a serious yet not insurmountable addiction, and the time allocated by the juvenile court for my client, Tiffany Sackett, to extricate herself from this addiction. Your Honors, my name is Megan Lutz-Friefert, and I represent the appellant and mother in this case, Tiffany Sackett. Ms. Sackett was involved in the juvenile court system after Mr. Thompson chose to drive his vehicle drunk with his young daughters in the car. And after Mr. Thompson left the scene of the car accident and failed to get his daughters the immediate medical care that they needed, Ms. Sackett's children were injured due to Mr. Thompson's negligence.
Not Mr. Thompson was the custodial parent, was he not?
Yes, Judge.
So, had your client had any significant contact with the children at the time of the accident, prior to the accident?
Her contact was the same as a non-custodial parent.
She was exercising regular visitation?
That is my understanding, yes. Not only was Ms. Sackett dealing with the emotional, with her drug addiction, she was also dealing with the emotional repercussions of having her children injured in such a traumatic way and dealing with those emotional repercussions. And yet, the juvenile court provided Ms. Sackett with a mere 6 months and 12 days to rehabilitate herself from her addiction. This is less than 200 days, Your Honor. As this court well knows, the purpose of the juvenile court is to rehabilitate a parent, and in the circumstances of Tiffany Sackett, that didn't happen. It is our strong conviction here today that to provide a parent with a mere 6.5 months to rehabilitate herself and to complete an expansive, detailed plan set by the juvenile court sets that parent up for failure, even though it makes it appear that the parent failed when actually it was the child court that failed the parent by not providing enough time.
In those first 6 months, what services were offered?
Yes. So in the first 6 months, Ms. Sackett was offered eight different things. She was offered a psychosocial assessment, also known as an IDI, or an initial diagnostic interview, which she completed. She was offered a chemical dependency evaluation, which she completed. That was in the very first court order on April 19, 2017.
Did she follow up on the recommendations that were made after that evaluation?
And that is where some issues began to arise. Ms. Sackett was court ordered to do an ASM level 2 intensive outpatient treatment program. She did not follow up on that, but that was also never set up for her by her caseworker. There's no testimony from the caseworker that this was ever set up. In fact, the caseworker's testimony was that she expects parents to set up their own services. The caseworker's testimony was also that she provides a family support worker for the parent to help them set up services, but there was no testimony in this case that Wendy Stevenson set that up for Ms. Sackett. There's no testimony that she had a family support worker.
Didn't Ms. Stevenson testify that it was oftentimes hard to communicate with your client?
That was her allegation. However, we do not know how often she attempted to contact Ms. Sackett. We don't know how she attempted to contact Ms. Sackett.
How often did your client attempt to contact her?
The record is void of that, yeah.
Doesn't the parent have some responsibility when she knows that she may have her parental rights terminated? Would a parent not have some motivation to make sure she is complying with the requirements that the juvenile court set out?
Yes, Your Honor. And the motivation here we see by her having completed that chemical dependency evaluation and completing her biopsychosocial assessment and continuing to attend visitation. In fact, the testimony from the visitation worker was that the mother was highly appropriate on visits. She was doing things correctly. She had made her daughter Allie do homework while on visits, cooked her daughter Allie meals. And for her daughter Kaslyn, who was in the vegetative state, she actually sat with her, she would rub her hand, she would talk to her, stroke her hair, and act in a motherly nature.
I think the evidence is a little more conflicting than that, isn't it? There were times that she didn't show up for visitation at all.
That is...
And that was very devastating to Allie.
That is reflected in the record, Your Honor. However, you would, one thing to look at is when did the mother stop attending visits as regularly? The point where the mother stopped to attend visits as regularly was when Wendy Stevenson set her up on a call-to-confirm basis. She was set up on a call-to-confirm basis after missing a mere 2 visits with her children.
Was that unreasonable? Because the testimony was that it was so devastating for Allie that they just didn't want to take that chance anymore to have something set up and have your client not show up.
I believe that testimony was what was happening later on in the case, as the mother was not attending visits as well once she was set up on call to confirm.
Why were the visits suspended?
I don't believe visits were suspended until, and correct me if I'm wrong, Your Honor, but I believe they were suspended after the termination. I believe prior to that, they were unsupervised, and then they were switched to supervised visitation in November or December of 2016. And at that point, it was switched to supervised visitation because there were some emotional issues being dealt with, and Ms. Sackett didn't handle those well. That was the point where the Department of Health and Human Services had moved to have Chasm removed from life support because Chasm was in a persistent vegetative state, and doctors had determined that she would no longer, she would just remain in this state, and the best thing for her was to remove her from life support. However, the father objected to this, and the juvenile court denied that motion.
Didn't your client also make a statement to Ms. Stevenson that she couldn't be responsible if somehow she tripped over the cord?
Yes, Your Honor, she did make that statement. I believe that was an emotional statement driven by the high emotions of this case and the situation, seeing your child in a persistent vegetative state, never to run or play again.
Your client also had a significant substance abuse problem, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
The record reflects that the 77 tests, 42 of those tests that were provided, she was unsuccessful with respect to those during that period of time.
That is exactly accurate, Your Honor. She did fail to complete her UAs. However, it's insufficient. She had other things that she completed within this case. She completed her biopsychosocial assessment, and she completed the CD evaluation and continued to attend visitation. There's no testimony that her outpatient was ever set up. A psychiatric evaluation letter of agreement was authored before it was court ordered for Ms. Sackett to do, and it was never. There's no testimony that this was ever authored again, a letter of agreement allowing her to have the psychiatric evaluation. So she completed other areas of her court order, and from a due process standpoint, she should have been brought into the court and told that if she missed another UA or continued to miss her UA, that this would result in the termination of her parental rights. She needed an opportunity, Your Honor, to avail herself of services and to get herself out of the crippling drug addiction. And she needed the time. There's a case from the Nebraska Supreme Court, In Re Interest of CEE. The parents didn't have a drug addiction. They were court-ordered to complete an alcohol codependency program, so they did have alcohol addiction. And those parents were provided, from the time the rehabilitation plan was entered to the TPR, 14 months to rehabilitate themselves. And they had similar court orders to that of Ms. Sackett, and they were provided more time. And with time, people who have these types of addictions have the opportunity to overcome that. It's not something that you can just snap your fingers and get out of.
What progress did your client make over those initial 6 months?
The progress that Tiffany Sackett made was she continued to visit with her children in a meaningful manner. She completed her chemical dependency evaluation, and she completed her biopsychosocial assessment. The level 2 outpatient was never set up for her. The psychiatric evaluation, the letter of agreement that was authored, expired before it was court ordered, and then there was nothing offered after that. There's no testimony in the record as to a medication management, which was one of the things that was court ordered for her. And so that is the progress that she made. She made some progress. Minimal progress, but she did make progress, Your Honor. So I would argue that this case revealed a bond between the mother and her children, and that bond has never been disputed. The injustice in this case is whether or not a mere 7 months is a reasonable amount of time for a mother with these requirements placed on her to rehabilitate herself without adequate support. I am before you asking that you undo this injustice. The Nebraska Supreme Court in In Re Interest CEE said that 14 months is enough time for a parent to rehabilitate oneself, allowing the juvenile court to be a rehabilitative court rather than the court being more punitive and punishing a parent for their addiction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Laura Lemoyne, a senior certified law clerk. I'm treated as by Matt and Killian, who's a deputy Douglas County attorney representing the state of Nebraska in this matter. The issue today is whether the juvenile court was correct when they terminated appellant's parental rights after finding that the children were within the meanings of both subsections 2 and 6 of Nebraska.
Counsel, why the hurry? It's been 6 months.
I don't know that I would say there was a hurry. I think that in this case, in particular, the children had gone through a lot of traumatic events, and the department, along with the state, felt that permanency was of great importance. We didn't want the children to continue to languish in foster care, waiting for a parent who's not putting forth any effort at all to rehabilitate themselves. I guess rather than a question of why the hurry, I think it was more why wait.
Well, when I look at the statutory provision subsection 7 that says we look at 15 out of the last 22 months as a basis, this was less than half of that time.
Right. I mean, for you to use that subsection in order to terminate, you do have to meet the 15 out of 22 months. But there is no floor set up. The court's never ruled that there's a floor or a baseline that there needs to be X amount of months before we can move to terminate. It's a case-by-case basis, and there have been several other cases that this court has upheld with less than 6 months. Additionally, there was only 6 months between that time frame that appellant was being offered services for a year in this case. When the children were first removed from her care, October of 2016, and the termination hearing didn't occur until October of 2017. So when we look at it on the basis of when was the adjudication and when was the hearing actually held, it's 6 months, or when was the motion occurring, but overall from the time that she was offered services and the time that she actually had to rehabilitate herself, it was over a year.
Can you remind me, when was the accident? Can you remember the date of the accident?
I do not know, but I know that it was right around October 29th of 2016. That was the date that the children were removed, and we filed a petition that covered the father, as well as the appellant.
And the father's rights were previously terminated.
Correct, as well as another mother who was involved in the case. And both of their rights were terminated. Was taken up on appeal, and this court held that that was enough time, even though we moved for termination even sooner in that case.
Can you address the appellant's arguments that once the evaluations were performed, the department didn't do anything to set up the treatment for her?
Yes, both the visitation worker and the family permanency specialist testified regarding appellant's lack of ability to communicate and work with the department. They both testified regarding how often they would try to reach out to appellant and that there was just no contact whatsoever. She had no desire to utilize the services that were being offered, and they did set up the psychological evaluation, and that was expired in May, but as I said, she had already agreed voluntarily to work with these services, and that's why they were put in place for her back in October. So that's why the psych eval was set up, and she failed to follow through with that. Under subsection 2 of 43292, the court can terminate whenever the evidence shows that the parents have substantially, continuously, or repeatedly neglected to refuse and not give the juvenile the necessary parental care and protection. This can be established by a lack of parental motivation to place the child's interests above the interests of the parent. In in this case, I think there's an abundance of evidence that shows that there was a lack of parental motivation to place the children's interests ahead of their own. As the appellant stated, there were 8 different court orders and services put in place. A majority of these were being offered from October and continued to be offered up until the termination hearing. And despite all of those services being offered and available to the appellant, she failed to utilize those. In regards to the visitation, which is not exactly a court ordered, it shouldn't be a punishment for a parent who wants to earn the rights to their children back. It should be taken as an opportunity. And in this case, appellant's participation in visits were very, very disappointing. Along with the drug test, which we already learned, she had 77 total drug tests requested, 42 of which were unsuccessful. She was unsuccessfully discharged twice under that service due to her noncompliance.
They had to actually go to a different service, right, to get her, try to get her tested?
Right. They even went to the extent of having the workers go to her house and try to have her drug tested there. They started trying to go to her visits to have her do drug testing there, and after things got very escalated and it became inappropriate to subject the children to that, they decided to discontinue that service as well.
She would sometimes not answer the door, or if she answered the door, she'd say she can't give a test today or whatever.
Yes.
Can you address a little bit the bond between her and the children?
Well, I think that appellant tried to mention some of the few connections that she did have when she was present for visits. Yes, she did drug problems here and do things like that, but the percentages of her showing up for those visits and her failing to show up, I mean, she wasn't there the majority of the time, so the small bond that she may have had during those few visits she did attend, I think, is overcome by the pain and suffering that these kids went through when the mother would have a visit scheduled and kids would be on the way to go and see mom and she wouldn't show up. That's why she was put on the call to confirm basis, because it was traumatic for these children to be expecting to see their mom and at the last minute while they're heading to the place, mom doesn't show up or calls and cancels at the last minute. So while I do think it's natural for every child to have some kind of bond to their mom, in this case that was outweighed by the pain that they suffered just from mom's lack of motivation.
Also, the frequency of visits and the duration of the visits were continually reduced, correct?
Exactly. Let's see. It went through October, even at the termination hearing. I think she was supposed to have been given 4 visits, and she only attended 2. The percentages each month were less than half of the amount that she was offered and the amount of visits that she actually attended. And they just continued to decline. I think that also goes to show why the state felt the need to make this motion at the time that they did, rather than wait and continue to put these children through that experience. In sum, I think that the state provided far beyond evidence to show, beyond clear and convincing evidence, that termination was in the best interest of these children, and that the children fell within the meaning of both subsections 2 and 6. For that reason, we would ask this court to affirm the decision of the juvenile court.
Thank you, Counsel.
Is there any further?
15 seconds.
Can I go to court, sir?
Please.
The case of In Re Interest of CEE. Was May 6, 1988, when the children were removed from their home. The termination of parental rights did not occur until August 24, 1998. There was a significant amount of time for the parent to rehabilitate herself and that. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Matter submitted.